Hello, I'm Steve Ward-Booth, and this is Invisible Illnesses, episode 4. I'm a GP with a special interest in functional illnesses, but this is just the usual disclaimer to say that none of the information given here can be specific to you or others you might know, and is not a substitute for assessment and guidance from your own doctor, which is what we'd recommend if you or someone you know has concerns about your health.
Hi everyone, and welcome back to Invisible Illness Insights. I'm really pleased to say that Kieran Wilcox has kindly agreed to join us again for a follow-up from his initial chat with us. So, welcome back again, Kieran.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be back to see you both.
And obviously, as usual, Steve's here with me again.
Yeah, great to see and hear you all. Thanks again for coming back, Kieran. It's brilliant.
Brilliant. And just to kind of set us up in terms of why we've done another recording today, I suppose it's a couple of things here. And really, one of them is, I think Steve and I were talking about, which is saying that some of the things you talked about, some of it's quite specialised for you. And, you know, we were talking about a very specific tick infection that you got, which could be very different from other people's healthcare experiences. But actually, when we got under the surface, we felt there was an awful lot of there was an awful lot in your story, which is very relatable to lots and lots of other people. So we wanted to spend a bit of time talking about those things and kind of pulling them out from your story a little bit. And I think the second thing is that, you know, I guess you really made us think, and actually in doing so, we kind of came up with some bigger ideas that we wanted to discuss, rather than discussing it without you in the room, is to have you there and get your thoughts and reflections on some of the things that we were talking about. So is that okay? Or kind of talk through a few things and reflect on the things you told us. Does that work for you?
Of course, very happy to. It's flattering that it might be of interest to others, and if it's helpful, delighted.
Yeah, definitely. It's certainly hugely interesting to me. And so, but one of the things I just wanted to ask, which is a bit of a continuation on in terms of from last time in terms of fact finding, was we talked a bit about how important that graduated or phased return to work was in improving your situation. But I'm wondering if there's other stuff that you think might have helped, stuff that you did differently, because you talked about recognizing that things needed to be different, that you needed to do stuff differently, and I think humans all find change very difficult. But what kind of things do you think might also fit in that kind of category for you?
That's a big question. So, what did I do differently? Yeah. I think it can also be said as, what do I still do differently in order to stay upright now? And there's no probably silver bullet answer to it. It was a combination of things. I think, and each one adds a little bit of resilience and a little bit of extra capability and capacity. I think that one of the main things is acceptance that I can't do all the things that I used to do, and I still aspire and aim and talk and think about getting back to a place where I can do most of the things that I used to do, if not all, but accepting that I can't at the moment actually was quite difficult to do, and it was a major, not a turning point, but certainly a help. So that was important. Mm. Getting comfortable to ask for and accept help was a challenge, and still is. I've found, well, part of my persona and my own sort of sense of self was that I was the one that helped other people. I was the rock of support to family, friends, to an extent professionally, various different things, different roles, and asking for help. You know, there's a difference between knowing something and believing something, and I kind of always knew that people would help you, but believing it and then being comfortable doing it is not quite the same thing just as knowing. So that took a bit of time. And then there's some of the more practical things. So those are the sort of internal major things, but then there's some more sort of practical things of this thing about pacing, which is the core element for many. You're the people to say whether it's core from anything. My interpretation from the treatments that I've been through is that pacing is the main tool that is used for chronic fatigue type things as I have, and I found it really difficult. I still find it difficult. I find it really difficult now that I'm back to work. I only work 3 days because I need to have those rests in between in the week, but even within those days, I find it difficult not to then cram them full of the stuff that I would want to be trying to do in five. And what I've got to do is build in break points and rest points in order to be able to do more do less in the next hour or two in order to be able to do more in the next 24, 48, 72 hours.
Yeah. And I wonder if that comes back to the whole acceptance thing.
Yes.
Again, Kieran, it's that, because it's one of those things that really resonates for me, is that acceptance is a really easy word to say. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on around, you know, acceptance of kind of where you are. But the practicality of doing that, really internalising that and going, you know, I'm not at 100%, I'm at 70%, and I've got to be okay with that, because to your point, it's like I might be at 100% for today, but then I'd be at naught for the next 3 days. So I have to accept that I am where I am and I can't do everything. That's a big thing. It's an easy thing to say, but it's a very big thing to actually do.
It really is. And this difference between knowing something and believing something, that gulf can be really very, very wide.
Yeah.
And what I've found is that I'm not good at trying to work at 70% for the whole time. You know, in every day, I can't do that. I've tried, I failed. I'm not good at that. So the way that I'm operating at the moment, which is not perfect, but you know, is kind of working at okay, is having periods of time like a working day where I will be doing more, but knowing that I've got recovery time for it. So this three days of working gives me, so on the days that I'm not working, I have very deliberate sort of activities to try and maintain and develop that rest. And it's things like I'll have a lie in. It's a small thing, but just get another hour or two, you know, it adds up a few hours a week of extra sleep. I try to do some light exercise. It's not exercise as I would have described it previously when I was running a lot, but I'll make sure I get outside, I walk. I swim, so I do cold water swimming. I know it's a very popular sort of cliched thing, but I found that to be really helpful over the last 4 years or so that I've been doing it. It helps mentally and physically.
Do you notice anything physically different? Because that's a very physical thing to do.
So I noticed that when I was first really, really, when I was much sicker than I am now and was getting significant post-exertional malaise, I didn't seem to get it from cold water swimming. And albeit cold water swimming is different from, I used to, you know, pound up and down pools or a lake, you know, cold water swimming is not a kilometre of head down swimming. It's, you know, it's 10 to 15 minutes of head up sort of thoughtful swimming, but I didn't get the same exertional malaise from it. I find that my heart rate drops significantly afterwards, to a degree that it doesn't for any other activity. I associate that with the cold. I get something similar, but to a lesser degree, from cold showers, which I, for right or wrong, I have had almost exclusively cold showers for the last 4 years now, and actually quite enjoy them now. Weirdly, you kind of get that sort of, you get that same tingly feeling afterwards that you get out of the swimming. And the other thing that it helps me with is that it's a moderated activity. If I was to go for a run, and I haven't for a long time now, but I did try to about a year and a half ago, I tried to do a sort of couch to 5K zero, so working up to being able to run a bit from zero type program. And I found it really difficult to moderate my effort, because I could remember the fact that I used to run marathons. And so when I go out and say, oh, actually, this feels okay. And then I'd just do too much. And then I'd be knackered for days. Mm-hmm. Whereas you can't really spend more than 6 or 7 or 8 minutes in cold water. Or if you do, you come out shivering. And so it's got that sort of moderation. A bit like walking the kids to school. You know, it's bounded. Mm-hmm. It's externally bounded, which stops me from pushing.
So, and there's, so the, is there anything else you do that lowers your heart rate back to to the levels that used to be your kind of normal heart rate?
The only two things that do it are cold water, so the swimming, and the other one, weirdly, is I joined a choir in about a year ago, just after last Easter, and during choir practices and performances, and I can associate it only with the breathing, because you obviously have quite your breath, it's effectively breath work, but breath work with a purpose. It drops during that. So and it
wow,
and in but
that's
and,
really
and,
interesting.
So while I sleep, if I'm doing well and I've had a couple of weeks of sort of relatively well managed activity, my heart rate overnight might drop to 68 or 9 maybe. But after cold water swimming, and when singing, I can see it occasionally in the 50s.
Okay. I don't know if now might be a good time, because I'm going to have to say something, because this is so interesting, and there's so many thoughts that I'd like to run past you about things I've heard other patients tell me and stuff I've, you know, that research has shown and that kind of thing. And I wonder if any of this might be relevant. But we talked a bit about a number of things that I think are relevant. And again, the complexity is really, you know, all these different things feeding back in different ways can make this really confusing to talk about. But we talked about, there's a number of things I think that are relevant from when we spoke last time. So there was something about, there's something about context and links it about identity. And one of the big things you discovered on this journey was how much your work was part of your identity as a person who achieves a lot of stuff, okay? And you've also taken that a little bit further just now when you've talked about the difficulty you had in the idea of accepting or accepting help when you're normally the person who helps everybody else. And that is a theme that I see over and over and over again in a variety of illnesses. So the you know, which again, we're going to touch on the whole idea of stigma. And we see the stigma rooted a lot of the time in either people who don't know much about this, or indeed the person suffering from it, in some way having critical thoughts about they're getting these symptoms because they are in some way more fragile, more pain sensitive.
Yes, it's my
weaker,
fault. What have I done?
Yes, exactly.
Those sorts of thoughts. Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. And whereas what we observe is very much the opposite that is true. So it tends to be people who have a very strong sense of duty often disproportionately affects people who are the rock, who deal with everybody else, who are carers for other people, often have chosen caring professions specifically, but often are you know, maybe in stressful situations because of their caring roles, because they can't or wouldn't want to say no to their looking after their elderly relative or their children or other people who might be dependent on them, or their colleagues in their workplace. So it's actually, you know, we disproportionately see these illnesses affect people with those kind of drivers and personality types. Now, so there's something here about identity. So if you and context, because one of the things I wonder about is again going back to something that you felt, and I think we want to talk about good pain and bad pain and that kind of thing. Now, you talked about the way you sort of nurtured yourself in the past. You know, if you were busy and had a lot on at work and you needed to restore yourself, you'd go and climb a mountain and sit at the top and look at the view and feel better from it. And that wouldn't work for you now, because or at a point in your illness it wouldn't have worked for you.
I'd get a mental stimulant to it, but the physical balance wouldn't be there.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, one of the things is that mountain climbing has something attached to it that your work had attached to it. Is there's a sense of, amongst all the other things, there's some difficulty to get through, and there's some accomplishment at the end. There's a goal to achieve. It's that summit. Yeah. I bet you've hardly ever walked 3/4 of the way up a hill, Kieran, and then gone down again.
Pretty rarely. Yeah.
Yeah. And so there's something about the goal and an accomplishment. Now, when you cold water immerse yourself, there's not really a goal or an accomplishment. You're not you know you can only stay in for a certain length of time, but it's not like going out and trying to beat your personal best on your marathon time. It's not like trying to get to the top of the mountain. It's not like trying to finish the project that you everyone's relying on you to get done at work. There's not a goal. It's not goal directed. It is what it is, and you're doing it for the experience and for that alone.
Yeah. And no, so there's probably something in that. Yeah.
There's nothing you can fail at. Okay. So whilst what we heard from you that we don't always hear, I don't always hear from people, so it made you a little bit more unusual, was that your what drives you is a lot about carrot and not so much about stick. Okay. But there's probably some stick in there as well. But you may be a little bit less aware of that stick component to it. But once you can't do, or it feels like you're not going to be able to do the stuff that you want to do, that's part of your identity, then that stick starts to become more of an issue. You know, what if I can't get this stuff done? How am I going to feel? And if you've got activities which don't have any stick to them, they've just got carrot, then, or even no carrot and no stick, they just are what they are, and they do something positive for you without that, then maybe that's why there's no post-excursional malaise.
It might be.
And maybe it's why there are physiological reasons why cold water immersion might lower your heart rate. I'm not sure there are the same physiological or exclusively physiological reasons why singing might lower heart rate. You've mentioned breathing, but we know breathing exercises can lower heart rate. I'd always understood the mechanism is that it produces a very deep relaxation state, like a meditative or mindfulness type state. And there may be something in both those activities, because certainly cold water can put up heart rate as well. So I wonder if that's the thing that unifies those two activities. What do you think?
I think it could well be. I think you've just said exactly what I was then going to go on to say about mindfulness and meditation type things, because that's one of the other big things that I've done over the last few years, which has been really helpful and was one of the main treatments that I received was learning how to and then getting into the habit of doing mindfulness. And some of that is just stopping and looking at the flowers in the park and the blossom. And actually, that's just a positive thing for anybody to do. But that is tied into a singing activity, a swimming activity, because they are times that you are in the moment and you're nowhere
Absolutely.
Else.
Absolutely.
That's the point. And I used to get that from the mountains, and I also used to get it from a hobby that I've had for a long time is woodworking. I've always enjoyed doing, and I still do, but I do it much less now. I don't have the energy budget for it, but I used to like that because you have to pay attention, especially when you're using a bandsaw, you know, that sort of thing. But it's mindful attention, because it's not, your brain isn't wandering, you're not doing lots of different things, you're measuring, is the measurement right, the chisel going in the right place, I get that from the swimming, I get that from the singing, and I suppose trying to find that from other things is which don't have pass or fail criteria.
I think that's one of the things which I've found myself talking about a lot with people who are experiencing these illnesses, and one of the things that I think is I've said change is hard, but I think that's one of the hardest things to try and change, and is it harder for us people who have been quite driven and pushed ourselves hard in a variety of ways, and I can identify with lots of this stuff, and having learned to do mindfulness relatively recently, I find it astonishing that I had to actively learn to sort of look at a flower and enjoy it for what it is. But I'd forgot, and you watch children do this, young children do this all the time. But we kind of train ourselves out of it, I think. So we forget how to do a lot of this stuff. It sounds weird that you have to relearn it, but I think you do. I mean, obviously, you've got a really striking view at the top of a mountain. You know that hits you, but all the wonderful stuff around you all the time that we can take for granted and not notice.
You've just triggered a maybe not a eureka moment, but a connection that I haven't made before. when in my specific case around my woodworking thing, which I talked about as being a mindful thing, I've stopped doing it quite a lot over the last year or two because I found it a very frustrating thing, because it's a mindfulness process, but it has a goal, because whatever you're doing is a project. You might be making a set of shelves, or it might be making a chopper board or whatever. And because I was finding that end piece was so much further away, and I hadn't connected that's because it was a goal, or so I actually still enjoyed the process, but I stopped doing it because, oh God, it becomes then a list of stuff I haven't achieved rather because yes. It's taking me longer. So yes. That's quite actually just a helpful for me as a takeaway to do it for the process rather than the goal, and having more of those things in life actually enable us to achieve more.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think it's hard to do, isn't it? And like a lot of people find mindfulness hard to do because it starts to be something, even just the exercise of mindfulness. And people think it's about trying to clear my mind and not think anything at all, which is of course impossible. And then they feel like they're failing at that. And then that makes them more stressed and more frustrated. And a lot of people just, can't find... And it took me a lot of attempts to try and different ways to have it explained to me to learn to do it. And I still don't think I'm very good at it a lot of the time. So these things are skills, I think, that can take practice and can be frustrating. And perhaps aren't for everybody either. But yeah.
And needs repetition. One of the things that the chronic fatigue specialist said to me, who was also my mindful teaching me some mindfulness stuff, she said, if it was a pill, you'd take it every day, whether it made you feel better that day or not. And you've got to approach it in the same way, because the benefits are cumulative.
Yeah, that's a lovely analogy.
It's really nice. And I just wanted to kind of step back at this point, because we've talked a lot about the specifics for you, Kieran. Yeah. I'm just conscious of kind of someone's listening to the call, and I've been cold water swimming with you, and it's amazing. But I'm not quite as tough as you. I could see why it wouldn't be for everyone. I think what we're not necessarily saying here is it's about those specific activities.
Yeah.
For me, the learning is about what works for you, what brings you joy. And I remember I read a book recently called 4,000 Weeks, which I think I've talked to both of you about, and it talks about this theme of this atelic activities, which is a term I hadn't heard before, but it's essentially where the goal of doing the activity is just the doing it itself. There's no bigger thing than that. And it talks a lot about essentially hobbies are those things, and they've become those things that we don't do anymore. It's become unfashionable to have hobbies because it's slightly kind of, why aren't you being more productive? But actually those in themselves are important. So I think for people listening, for me, the takeout is, you don't have to kind of get into meditation or get into cold water swimming. It's what do you do that just brings you joy to do it and doesn't feel like a pressured activity? And think about those things and how do you get more of those into your life and make time for those things. That feels really important to me, because I think that brings us on to a theme which I think is important to talk about, which is rest, which is one of the things I took out, and I know we've sort of talked about separately, Kieran, is this idea of rest. When you are someone who is used to doing things and achieving things, it's how do you get to that rest point? Because I think, for me, it's not just stopping, because that becomes stressful in itself to just force yourself to do nothing. Yeah. So I don't know if you could talk about kind of rest at all for you and your experience of that.
Oh, I'm terrible at rest. And it must be different for different people, right? Which is what I'm starting to learn. Because for me, resting is not stopping. Reading a book I like to read, but only up to a certain point. The idea of going on a beach holiday where all you do is sit on the beach and read books is purgatory for me. Active rest was, and that's been the real challenge of trying to find that. So what is it that constitutes rest and how productive rest?
I think Alex has probably got the closest to answering this, because I think it is very difficult. I mean, it's probably impossible to answer in a generic sense, but I think it is what brings you joy. But I think there's a trade-off in that if I'm somebody who used to get joy by I still do get joy by challenging myself and then achieving that thing and going through some degree of discomfort and pain to do that, then I have to recognise that there's something else about that joy, okay? Which is there's a trade-off.
Substituting
there.
In some way.
Yeah. So perhaps the kind of joy that we're looking for is not necessarily the kind of joy that we attach to huge success, Because we do get joy from success, of course we do. But can we get joy from other things? And those, and the degree of joy might not be as great, but there isn't a price to pay for it in terms of some sort of expenditure, emotional expenditure or physical expenditure or whatever it is. And maybe that's the way to think about it. So we are looking for littler things. And again, it's about, there's another analogy here. We've talked about the wave, the peaks and troughs of boom and bust activity. And Kieran, you've illustrated how difficult it is to flatten them off completely because it's so anathema. It's so different to how we've previously done stuff. But maybe there is some flattening off in terms of what we're looking for in terms of our joy and our relaxation. And that doesn't mean that we can't still challenge ourselves at different points in our lives, in our jobs, or in other things. But that we should be also be looking for those regular little peaks that are joys that don't cost us emotionally before, after, or during.
I buy that absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And just to kind of then sort of move us towards the kind of I'm conscious of time and sort of start to wrap things up. I think one final area that I think we haven't talked about, and I think it's important, is that it sort of links into those kind of doing activities for their own right. Part of that is about the impact the impact of other people, that what other people will think. And I think that's a bit of your story that I think is really important for us to talk about here. And I know we talked about a little bit around it, but I'd like to kind of spend a bit more time on this. Is the sort of stigma attached to what you had, Kieran? And I think that's where this story becomes very relatable for everyone, because it would have been very easy for you to say, you know, you had this diagnosis of this tick bite, very rare. You know, you could just tell everyone, oh, it was just that. And there's no, if you like, there's no payoff there. You know, everyone would go, oh, God, that sounds awful. An exotic disease, you know, that's terrible. But I certainly know from my own experience, I was like, when I was struggling with COVID, I wanted to have a broken leg or a broken arm or something like that I could point to say, this is the issue. This is what's going on.
Something you can fix.
And I didn't have that.
You have a plan to fix it.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I wonder if you could talk about that, because it feels like that's very relevant to your story too, is what you had to tell other people and how you felt about that. You know, you talked about being responsible for 300 people at work. You know, it sounds like you have a big audience to, if you like, talk to when you talk about these things. Did that play a role for you in terms of stigma?
There was probably stages in that. The first place that played out was in my own head. And my own sort of acceptance and understanding of it. And then there is the way that you then describe that to your nearest and dearest who are deeply interested. And then those that are, you've got sort of concentric rings of people that have at lower levels of interest and involvement. And you need a slightly different version, just for brevity and understanding, right? As you go through. But you've still got to understand the core, or I've always felt, try to understand the core of it, because if I don't, I've got to make sure whatever I'm telling to others for their understanding, I've got to be telling myself I've got to understand it properly, right? And I think the best thing that I've come to is that I had this tick bite, I had this exotic thing which is similar to Lyme disease, but it was probably the straw that broke the camel's back, on top of not having really been careful enough over 20 years of burning the candle at both ends. And it's no good to just treat that infection if I don't treat if I don't take some other things off the camel.
I think it's really interesting, and I think one of the things I'd like to say is that there's two categories of stigma, and you've talked about one is that your own view of yourself, and the other is what other people are thinking. Now I actually think that they are the same thing, but one is a filtered version. And because we are pack tribe animals and hardwired as such, our own personal view of ourselves is intensely linked to an instinctive idea of being valued by the people around us.
Yes, a projection and all,
absolutely. Yeah. And we'll often see a mismatch in that we may undervalue ourselves, you know, in a way that the people around us don't undervalue us, and that can be. And I see a lot of people for whom that's the problem. And this link. So I think they're one and the same thing. I think we are hardwired, and I think this is a really important driver for a stress response that might not be the initial trigger of these illnesses, but I think it kicks in very early. And I think that people often don't recognise it as don't recognise themselves to be stressed because they're not anxious, for example, or there isn't some other external factor. And they say, or it's normal to be stressed by the fact that I can't work or I can't play football anymore or any of those other things. So this is it's a normal response, and which of course it is, but it's still a stress response. And that stress response starts to produce its own physiological changes, which then causes illnesses to persist or worsen long after an original insult might well have healed.
Yes.
Now, one of the things here is we've got something about we've talked about how it is people who are very driven that might do this because they're pushing themselves harder, probably driven by all the same reasons, and this may be the difference between people who are able to push the marathons you do or have done or endurance runs. You've had to push through an awful lot, so you've got very good at pushing through pain. You've used that term more than once, I think, over the two yeah. things. So you've pushed yourself for longer, but also a function of that is that. And again, this is going back to something you said earlier. You sort of rather apologetically talked about your baseline levels as saying, I don't want to sound big-headed or braggy. But you weren't being big-headed or braggy, you were being very factual. And the fact is, and I can say this very easily, you're someone who's achieved in life at very, very high levels, higher than most of us. So at some level, you know that. You've got a sense of worth, and also it was very evident that your employers valued you, and they showed you that they the time you had off, the way they supported you back, but that's they're not doing that just purely out of the kindness of their heart. They're doing that because you have inherent value to them as an organisation, and I'm not to say they're not kind people. But the reason that they value you like that is because you have this inherent value, and at some level you know that. Now, a lot of people, like Alex said, we talked a lot about your experience, but imagine we're in a situation where we don't have that sense of self-worth. You know, perhaps our early life was
so much harder.
Very absolutely. Difficult, very yeah. difficult. And a lot of people, it is very much harder to get out of these illnesses because... probably the symptoms are more severe because the cortisol responses and all that sort of stuff are much more marked, because there are past experiences or trauma which produce high stress states, and life experiences which don't teach somebody that they are, you know, that they're worth lots. And so they don't have the inherent belief. And this, again, you said something really wise earlier, Kieran, about knowing and believing. And a lot of people know that they do their job very well, but they don't necessarily believe it inside. And that's really tough to get around. And some people are very aware of that mismatch, but it doesn't always mean that it's easy to fix in that situation. And stigma, of course, then builds from all those places. So stigma adds to that sense as well, so that there's so the externalised stuff.
Yeah, so there's a thing in there about having... It's self-confidence and self-worth, I suppose, that can easily be knocked by this. And I've never been accused of having an absence of that. You know, quite the reverse often, actually, in life. Certainly when younger. I suppose believing that you are worth something helps. You know, we all need to do that, right? And that I think is an important way of getting through. One of the things you said in there as well, which was particularly interesting to me, was that not being anxious is not the same as not being stressed, and that you get that physical response even. And obviously, if you are anxious as well, then that would make it worse. But not being doesn't mean you're not having those stress responders, that's worth remembering, because you can achieve those things even if you don't necessarily notice that you. Receive rather than achieve. Receive those sort of physical elements of stress, even though
yeah, feeling anxious and panicky, or having an anxious and panicky thoughts, are symptom of an underlying stress state.
Yes.
Just like a rise in heart rate might be a symptom of an underlying stress state, and two people might get two different sets of symptoms to the same underlying thing. Just like, you know, one person can catch a cold virus and have a dominant sore throat, and the other person catch the same virus and have more of a runny nose.
Yeah.
So we have these differences from one person to another. And I get the final thing about stigma is that, again, it was something that you said that in almost one of the greatest values that the positive blood test gave you in terms of mitigating a lot of this was that for the people further out of your circle who ask you how you are or what's been going on and aren't really that interested and you don't want to bore them, and you can give them a nice, quick, simple answer that makes sense to them.
Yes.
And the
Which
fact
is bounded
that
in truth. And yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely. But what we should recognise is that what we're instinctively glossing over is that what makes sense to people, us, other people, instinctively, at the moment, at this point in human history, is a very medicalized explanation.
Yeah.
You know,
yes.
You know, so I had a tick bite and got a long illness afterwards. And so you've got a medical explanation. But if you hadn't had any abnormal blood tests,
this
wouldn't have made sense. And we've got a mismatch here, disconnect with the fact that in general, our worldview is that doesn't make sense. And yet what we've recognised is that these illnesses are extremely common. Okay? And what you've recognised is that your experience is almost certainly due to more than just the tick bite. Okay? And not everybody makes that assumption. And this is another of your strengths, that even from the outset, you had a very broad and open-minded view about what might be driving this. And although you didn't recognise and you didn't use the word stress or anxiety, you recognised that there was something about that period of work before the tick bite that was exhausting, that had taken some kind of toll. And you didn't know the extent of it at that time, but you recognised it at the time, you recognised it more afterwards and to a greater extent even later as well. So you recognised the complexity in this. But a lot of the time, lots of us are not. And the whole medicalised process maybe doesn't help us to see what's actually in front of us in plain sight, that lots of the illnesses that lots of us are experiencing, you know, don't fit that medical brief, and yet we somehow need that to understand it,
which is unhelpful. Valid for the fact that you can't put an easy label on.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's, you know, I think that probably is a really nice note for us to end on there, because I think, it will be, first of all, a huge thank you to you, Kieran. I think it's important to say why we're saying thank you. One is thank you for being so open and honest again and sharing your kind of story, because I think there's lots and lots in there that I think will be really, really helpful to people. But I think also just thank you for being that kind of open-minded about it, because I think that's the important thing here, is that, you know, it's not about... and that's the kind of message I think we're trying to convey with this podcast, is it's not necessarily about, where you are. It's about being open-minded enough about the options available to you to then find those solutions that will work for you. So I think your story will be really helpful for people who are in perhaps, you know, very different illnesses, but can some of the things you've said can resonate with, to see that there is a way through this, and there is a kind of positive outcome. So, but you know, before we close, you know, how has that felt for you talking about
I'm pleased to be able to help in any way that I can, and it is a great service that you're doing to put some light on this. So to be able to contribute in a small way is a great pleasure, and it's really lovely to talk to you both.
Great. Thanks so much, Kieran. I'd echo everything Alex says. You've really helped me crystallise certain ideas and give me some lovely phrases, which sum things up, which are lovely ways of putting across complex ideas. So I'm truly grateful.
Brilliant. Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much. And thanks, everyone, for listening.
Well, Alex, that was great. Thanks so much for introducing me to Kieran and getting him along. What an incredible guy. What an interesting, fascinating story. We're going to look forward to the next episode. We're going to go a slightly different direction. We're going to be bringing in Tony Davies, who is an expert in chronic pain. and particularly within that field, has sort of moved the whole field forward in terms of understanding and helping people with fibromyalgia syndromes and other central sensitization illnesses. And some of the stuff we talked about today with Kieran's stop signals comes from Tony's work. So it'd be great to have a genuine expert with research and publications and a huge, huge, even longer experience than me working with people with these kinds of problems. So how does that sound, Alex?
Sounds great. Yeah, looking forward to it. Great stuff.
All right. See you next time.
Great stuff. Cheers then. Thanks, everyone.
Bye.